must be for about 99% of the people in the world. You're in this place. There's other people all around you, but they don't understand you, and you don't understand them, but people do a lot of pointless babbling anyway. In order to stay alive, you have to spend all day, every day, doing stupid, meaningless work. And the only way to get out of it is to quit, cut loose, take a flyer, and go off into the wicked world where you will be swallowed up and never heard from again. She's not especially good at cutting up fish. The big, stout Russian chicks, stomping, slab-faced babushkas, keep giving her a hassle. They keep hovering, watching her cut with this look on their face like they can't believe what a dork she is. Then they try to show her how to do it the right way, but she's still not so good at it. It's hard, and her hands are cold and stiff all the time. After a couple of frustrating days, they give her a new job, farther down the production line. They turn her into a cafeteria dame, like one of the slop slingers in the high school lunchroom. She works in the galley of one of the big Russian ships, hauling vats of cooked fish stew out to the buffet line, ladling it out into bowls, shoving it across the counter at an unending line consisting of religious fanatics, and more religious fanatics. Except this time around, there seems to be a lot more Asians and hardly any Americans at all. They have a new species here, too. People with antennas coming out of their heads. The antennas look like the ones on cop walkie-talkies, short, blunt, black rubber whips. They rise up from behind the ear. The first time she sees one of these people, she figures it must be some kind of new Walkman, and she wants to ask the guy where he got it, what he's listening to. But he's a strange guy, stranger than all of the others, with a permanent thousand-yard stare and a bad case of the mumbles, and he ends up giving her the creep so bad that she just shoves an extra-large dose of stew in his face and hurries him on down the line. From time to time, she actually recognizes one of the people who are in the van, but they don't seem to recognize her. They just look right through her, glassy-eyed, like they've been brainwashed. Like YT was brainwashed. She can't believe it has taken her this long to figure out what they were doing to her. And that just makes her more pissed. In reality, Port Sherman is a surprisingly tiny little burg, really just a few square blocks. Until the raft came along, it had a full-time population of a couple of thousand people. Now the population must be pushing 50,000. Hiro has to slow down a little bit here, because the refuse are all sleeping on the street for the time being, an impediment to traffic. That's okay. It saves his life. Because shortly after he gets into Port Sherman, the wheels on his motorcycle lock up, the spokes become rigid, and the ride gets very bumpy. A couple of seconds after that, the entire bike goes dead, becomes an inert chunk of metal. Not even the engine works. He looks down into the flat screen on top of the fuel tank, wanting to get a status report, but it's just showing snow. The BIOS has crashed. Asheraz possessed his bike. So he abandons it in the middle of the street, starts walking toward the waterfront. Behind him, he can hear the refuse waking up, struggling out of their blankets and sleeping bags, converging over the fallen bike, trying to be the first to claim it. He can hear a deep thumping in his chest, and for a minute, he remembers Raven's motorcycle in L.A., how he felt it first and heard it later. But there are no motorcycles around here. The sound is coming from above. It's a chopper, the kind that flies. Hiro can smell the seaweed rotting on the beach. He's so close. He comes around a corner and finds himself on the waterfront street, looking straight into the facade of the Spectrum 2000. On the other side is water. The chopper's coming up the fjord, following it inland from the open sea, headed straight for the Spectrum 2000. It's a small one, an agile number with a lot of glass. Hiro can see the crosses painted all over it where the red stars used to be. It is brilliant and dazzling in the cool blue light of early morning because it's shedding a trail of stars, blue-white magnesium flares, tumbling out of it every few seconds, landing in the water below, where they continue to burn, leaving an astral pathway marked out down the length of the harbor. They aren't there to look cool. They are there to confuse heat-seeking missiles. From where he's standing, he can't see the roof of the hotel because he's looking straight up at it. But he has the feeling that Gurov must be waiting there, on top of the tallest building in Port Sherman, waiting for a dawn evacuation to carry him away into the porcelain sky, carry him away to the raft. Question: why is he being evacuated? And why are they worried about heat-seeking missiles? Hero realizes, belatedly, that some heavy shit is going on. If he still had the bike, he could ride it right up the fire stairs and find out what's happening. But he doesn't have the bike. A deep thump sounds from the roof of a building on his right. It's an old building, one of the original pioneer structures from 100 years ago. Hiro's knees buckle, his mouth comes open, shoulders hunch involuntarily. He looks toward the sound, and something catches his eye. Something small and dark, darting away from the building and up into the air like a sparrow. But when it's 100 yards out over the water, the sparrow catches fire, coughs out a great cloud of sticky yellow smoke, turns into a white fireball, and springs forward. It keeps getting faster and faster, tearing down the center of the harbor until it passes all the way through the little chopper, in through the windshield and out the back. The chopper turns into a cloud of flame, shedding dark bits of scrap metal like a phoenix breaking out of its shell. Apparently, Hero's not the only guy in town who hates Gurov. Now Gurov has to come downstairs and get on a boat. The lobby of the Spectrum 2000 is an armed camp full of beards with guns. They're still putting their defense together. More soldiers are dragging themselves out of their coin lockers, pulling on their jackets, grabbing their guns. A swarthy guy, probably a totter sergeant left over from the Red Army, is running around the lobby in a modified Soviet Marine's uniform, screaming at people, shoving them this way and that. Gurov may be a holy man, but he can't walk on water. He'll have to come out to the waterfront street, make his way 2 blocks down to the gate that admits him to the secured pier, and get on board the Kodiak Queen, which is waiting for him, black smoke starting to cough out of its stacks, lights starting to come on. Just down the pier from the Kodiak Queen is the Kowloon, which is the big Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong boat. Hero turns his back on the Spectrum 2000 and starts running up and down the waterfront streets, scanning the logos until he sees the one he wants, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. They don't want to let him in. He flashes his passport. The doors open. The guard is Chinese, but speaks a bit of English. This is a measure of how weird things are in Port Sherman. They have a guard on the door. Usually, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong is an open country, always looking for new citizens, even if they are the poorest refuse.
"Sorry," the guard says in a reedy, insincere voice. "I did not know."
He points to Hero's passport. The Franchulet is literally a breath of fresh air. It doesn't have that third-world ambiance, doesn't smell like urine at all. Which means it must be the local headquarters, or close to it, because most of Hong Kong's Port Sherman real estate probably consists of nothing more than a gunman hogging a payphone in a lobby. But this place is spacious, clean, and nice. A few hundred refuse stare at him through the windows, held at bay, not by the mere plate glass, but by the eloquent promise of the 3 rat-thing hutches lined up against one wall. From the looks of it, 2 of those have just been moved in recently. Pays to beef up your security when the raft is coming through. Hero proceeds to the counter. A man is talking on the phone in Cantonese, which means that he is, in fact, shouting. Hero recognizes him as the Port Sherman proconsul. He is deeply involved in this little chat, but he has definitely noticed Hero's swords, is watching him carefully.
"We are very busy,"
the man says, hanging up. "Now you are a lot busier," Hero says. "I would like to charter your boat, the Kowloon."
It's very expensive, the man says. I just threw away a brand new top-of-the-line motorcycle in the middle of the street because I didn't feel like pushing it half a block to the garage, Hiro says. I am on an expense account that would blow your mind.
It's broken.
I appreciate your politeness in not wanting to come out and just say no, Hiro says. But I happen to know that it is, in fact, not broken. And so I must consider your refusal equivalent to a no.
It's not available, the man says. Someone else is using it.
It has not yet left the pier, Hiro says. So you can cancel that engagement using one of the excuses you have just given me, and then I will pay you more money.
We cannot do this, the man says.
Then I will go out into the street and inform the refuse that the Kowloon is leaving for L.A. in exactly 1 hour, and that they have enough room to take 20 refuse along with them. First come, first serve, Hiro says.
No,
the man says. I will tell them to contact you personally.
Where did you want to go on the Kowloon?
The man says. The raft.
Oh, well, why didn't you say so?
The man says.
That's where our other passenger's going.
You've got someone else who wants to go to the raft?
That's what I said. Your passport, please.
Hiro hands it over. The man shoves it into a slot. Hiro's name, personal data, and mugshots are digitally transferred into the Franchlet's BIOS. And with a little bit of key pounding, the man persuades it to spit out a laminated photo ID card.
You get onto the pier with this, he says. It's good for 6 hours. You make your own deal with the other passenger. After that, I never want to see you again.
What if I need more consular services?
I can always go out and tell people, the man says, that a nigger with swords is out raping Chinese refugees.
This isn't exactly the best service I've ever had at a Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong.
This is not a normal situation, the man says. Look out the window, asshole.
Not much has apparently changed down at the waterfront. The Orthos have organized the defense in the lobby of the Spectrum 2000. Furniture has been overturned, barricades set up. Inside the hotel itself, Hiro presumes furious activity is going on. It's still not clear whom the Orthos are defending themselves against. Making his way through the waterfront area, Hiro doesn't see much, just more Chinese refuse and baggy clothes. It's just that some of them look a lot more alert than others. They have a whole different effect. Most of the Chinese have their eyes on the mud in front of their feet and their minds on something else. But some of them are just strolling up and down the street, looking all around, alertly. And most of these people happen to be young men wearing bulky jackets and haircuts that are from a whole other stylistic universe than what the others are sporting. There is evidence of styling gel. The entrance to the rich people's pier is sandbagged, barbed wired, and guarded. Hiro approaches slowly, his hands in plain sight, and shows his pass to the head guard, who is the only white person Hiro has seen in Port Sherman. And that gets him onto the pier. Just like that. Like the Hong Kong Franchulet, it's empty, quiet, and doesn't stink. It bobs up and down gently on the tide, in a way that Hiro finds relaxing. It's really just a train of rafts. Plank platforms built over floating hunks of styrofoam. And if it weren't guarded, it would probably end up getting dragged out and lashed onto the raft. Unlike a normal marina, it's not quiet and isolated. Usually, people moor their boats, lock them up, and leave. Here, at least one person is hanging out on each boat, drinking coffee, keeping their weapons in plain sight, watching Hiro very intently as he strolls up the pier. Every few seconds, the pier thunders with footsteps, and one or two Russians run past Hiro, making for the Kodiak Queen. They are all young men, all sailor-soldier types, and they're diving onto the Kodiak Queen as if it's the last boat out of hell, being shouted at by officers running to their stations, frantically attending to their sailor chores. Things are a lot calmer on the Kowloon. It's guarded too, but most of the people appear to be waiters and stewards, wearing snappy uniforms with brass buttons and white gloves. uniforms that are intended to be used indoors, in pleasant, climate-controlled dining rooms. A few crew members are visible from place to place, their black hair slicked back, clad in dark windbreakers, to protect them from the cold and spray. Hiro can only see one man on the Kowloon who appears to be a passenger, a tall, slender Caucasian in a dark suit, strolling around, chatting into a portable telephone. Probably some industry jerk who wants to go out for a day cruise, look at the refuse on the raft while he's sitting in a dining room having a gourmet dinner. Hiro's about halfway down the pier when all hell breaks loose on shore in front of the Spectrum 2000. It starts with a long series of heavy machine gun bursts that don't appear to do much damage, but do clear the street pretty fast. 99% of the refuse just evaporate. The others, the young men Hiro noticed, pull interesting high-tech weapons out of their jackets and disappear into doorways and buildings. Hiro picks up the pace a little, starts walking backward down the pier, trying to get some of the larger vessels in between him and the action, so he doesn't get hit by a stray burst. A fresh breeze comes off the water and down the pier. Passing by the Kowloon, it picks up the smell of bacon frying and coffee brewing, and Hiro can't help but meditate on the fact that his last meal was half of a cheap beer and a Kelly's tap in a snoozing cruise. The scene in front of the Spectrum 2000 has devolved into a generalized roar of unbelievably loud white noise as all the people inside and outside of the hotel fire their weapons back and forth across the street. Something touches his shoulder. Hiro turns to brush it away, sees that he's looking down at a short Chinese waitress who has come down the pier from the Kowloon. Having gotten his attention, she puts her hands back where they were originally, to wit, plastered over her ears.
"You Hiro protagonist?"
she mouths, basically inaudible over the ridiculous noise of the firefight. Hiro nods, she nods back, steps away from him, jerks her head toward the Kowloon. With her hands plastered over her ears this way, it looks like some kind of a folk dance move. Hiro follows her down the pier. Maybe they're going to let him charter the Kowloon after all. She ushers him onto the aluminum gangplank. As he's walking across it, he looks up to one of the higher decks, where a couple of the crew members are hanging out in the dark windbreakers. One of them is leaning against the railing, watching the firefight through binoculars. Another one, an older one, approaches him, leans over to examine his back, slaps him a couple of times between the shoulder blades. The guy drops his binoculars to see who's pounding him on the back. His eyes are not Chinese. The older guy says something to him, gestures at his throat. He's not Chinese either. The binocular guy nods, reaches up with one hand, and presses a lapel switch. The next time he turns around, a word is written across his back in neon green electropigment. Mafia. The older guy turns away. His windbreaker says the same thing. Hiro turns around in the middle of the gangplank. There are 20 crew members in plain sight all around him. Suddenly, their black windbreakers all say, Mafia. Suddenly, they are all armed. I was planning to get in touch with Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong and file a complaint about their proconsul here in Port Sherman, Hiro jokes. He was very uncooperative this morning when I insisted on renting this boat out from under you. Hiro is sitting in the first-class dining room of the Kowloon. On the other side of the white linen tablecloth is the man Hiro had previously pegged as the industry creep on vacation. He's impeccably dressed in a black suit, and he has a glass eye. He is not bothered to introduce himself, as though he's expecting Hiro to know who he is already. The man does not seem amused by Hiro's story. He seems rather nonplussed.
So? Don't see any reason to file a complaint now, Hiro says.
Why not?
Well, because now I understand his reluctance not to displace you guys.
How come? You got money, don't you?
Yeah, but...
Oh,
the man with the glass eye says, and allows himself sort of a forced smile.
Because we're the Mafia, you're saying. Yeah, Hero says, feeling his face get hot. Nothing like making a total dickhead out of yourself. Nothing in the world like it. No siree, Bob. Outside, the gun battle is just a dim roar. This dining room is insulated from noise, water, wind, and hot flying lead by a double layer of remarkably thick glass, and the space between the panes is full of something cool and gelatinous. The roar does not seem as steady as it used to be. Fucking machine guns, the man says. I hate them. Maybe 1 out of 1,000 rounds actually hit something worth hitting, and they kill my ears. You want some coffee or something?
That'd be great.
We got a big buffet coming up soon. Bacon, eggs, fresh fruit you wouldn't believe.
The guy that Hero saw earlier up on the deck, pounding binocular man on the back, sticks his head into the room.
Excuse me, boss, but we're moving into, like, the third phase of our plan. Just thought you'd want to know. Thank you, Livio.
Let me know when the Ivans make it to the pier.
The guy sips his coffee, notices Hero looking confused.
See, we got a plan, and the plan is divided up into different phases.
Yeah, I got that.
The first phase was immobilization, taking out their chopper. Then we had phase two, which is making them think we were trying to kill them in the hotel. I think that this phase succeeded wonderfully.
Me too.
Thank you. Another important part of this phase was getting your ass in here, which is also done.
I'm part of this plan?
The man with the glass eyes smiles crisply.
If you were not part of this plan, you would be dead. So you knew I was coming to Port Sherman?
You know that chick YT? The one you have been using to spy on us?
Yeah.
No point in denying it.
Well, we have been using her to spy on you.
Why? Why the hell do you care about me?
That would be a tangent from our main conversation, which is about all the phases of the plan.
Okay. We just finished phase two.
Now, in phase three, which is ongoing, we allow them to think that they are making an incredible heroic escape, running down the street toward the pier.
Phase four!
Shouts Livio, the lieutenant.
Scusi,
the man with the glass eye says, scooting his chair back, folding his napkin back onto the table. He gets up and walks out of the dining room. Hero follows him above deck. A couple of dozen Russians are all trying to force their way through the gate onto the pier. Only a few of them can get through at once, and so they end up strung out over a couple of hundred feet, all running toward the safety of the Kodiak Queen. But a dozen or so manage to stay together in a clump, a group of soldiers forming a human shield around a smaller cluster of men in the center.
Bigwigs, the man with the glass eye says, shaking his head philosophically.
They all run crab-like down the pier, bent down as far as they can go, firing the occasional covering burst of machine gun fire back into Port Sherman. The man with the glass eye is squinting against a cool sudden breeze. He turns to Hero with a hint of a grin.
Check this out, he says,
and presses a button on a little black box in his hand. The explosion is like a single drumbeat coming from everywhere at once. Hero can feel it coming up out of the water, shaking his feet. There's no big flame or cloud of smoke, but there is a sort of twin geyser effect that shoots out from underneath the Kodiak Queen, sending jets of white, steamy water upward like unfolding wings. The wings collapse in a sudden downpour, and then the Kodiak Queen seems shockingly low in the water, low and getting lower. All the men who are running down the pier suddenly stop in their tracks.
Now,
binocular man mumbles into his lapel. There are some smaller explosions down on the pier. The entire pier buckles and writhes like a snake in the water. One segment in particular, the segment with the bigwigs on it, is rocking and seesawing violently, smoke rising from both ends. It has been blown loose from the rest of the pier. All of its occupants fall down in the same direction as it jerks sideways and begins to move, yanked out of its place. Hiro can see the tow cable rising up out of the water as it is stretched tight, running a couple of hundred feet to a small open boat with a big motor on it, which is now pulling out of the harbor. There's still a dozen bodyguards on the segment. One of them sizes up the situation, aims his AK-47 across the water at the boat that's towing them, and loses his brains. There's a sniper on the top deck of the Kowloon. All the other bodyguards throw their guns into the water.
"Time for phase five," the man with the glass eye says. "A big fucking breakfast."
By the time he and Hiro have sat back down in the dining room, the Kowloon has pulled away from the pier and is headed down the fjord, following a course parallel to the smaller boat that is towing the segment. As they eat, they can look out the window across a few hundred yards of open water and see the segment keeping pace with them. All the bigwigs and the bodyguards are on their asses now, keeping their centers of gravity low as the segment bucks nastily.
"When we get farther away from land, the waves get bigger," the man with the glass eye says.
"I hate that shit. All I want is to hang on to the breakfast long enough to tamp it down with some lunch."
"Amen," says Livio, heaping some scrambled eggs onto his plate.
"Are you going to pick those guys up?" Hiro says. "Or just let them stay out there for a while?"
"Fuck 'em. Let 'em freeze their asses off. Then when we bring them onto this boat, they'll be ready for it. Won't put up too much of a fight. Hey, maybe they'll even talk to us."
Everyone seems pretty hungry. For a while, they just dig into breakfast. After a while, the man with the glass eye breaks the ice by announcing how great the food is, and everyone agrees. Hiro figures it's okay to talk now.
"I was wondering why you guys were interested in me."
Hiro figures that this is always a good thing to know in the case of the Mafia.
"We're all in the same happy gang,"
the man with the glass eye says.
"Which gang is that?"
"Lagos's gang."
"Huh?"
"Well, it's not really his gang, but he's the guy who put it together. The nucleus around which it formed."
"How and why and what are you talking about?"
"Okay."
He shoves his plate away from him, folds up his napkin, puts it on the table.
"Lagos had all these ideas. Ideas about all kinds of stuff."
"So I noticed."
"He had stacks all over the place on all different topics. Stacks where he would pull together knowledge from all over the fucking map and tie it all together. He had these things stashed here and there around the metaverse, waiting for the information to become useful."
"More than one of them?" Hiro says.
"Supposedly. Well, a few years ago, Lagos approached L. Bob Rife."
"He did?"
"Yeah. See, Rife has a million programmers working for him. He was paranoid that they were stealing his data."
"I know that he was bugging their houses and so on."
"The reason you know that is because you found it in Lagos' stack. And the reason Lagos bothered to look it up is because he was doing market research, looking for someone who might pay him hard cash for the stuff he dug up in the Babylon Focalypse stack."
"He thought," Hiro says, "that L. Bob Rife might have a use for some viruses."
"Right. See, I don't understand all this shit. But I guess he found an old virus or something that was aimed at the elite thinkers."
"The technological priesthood," Hiro says. "The infocrats. It wiped out the whole infocracy of Sumer."
"Whatever."
"That's crazy," Hiro says. "That's like if you find out your employees are stealing ballpoint pens, you take them out and kill them. He wouldn't be able to use it without destroying all his programmers' minds."
"In its original form," the man with the glass eye says. "But the whole point is, Lagos wanted to do research on it."
"Informational warfare research."
"Bingo. He wanted to isolate this thing and modify it so it could be used to control the programmers without blowing their brains sky high."
"And did it work?"
"Who knows? Rife stole Lagos's idea. Just took it and ran with it. And after that, Lagos had no idea what Rife did with it. But a couple of years later, he started getting worried about a lot of stuff he was seeing.
Like the explosive growth in Reverend Wayne's pearly gates.
and these Ruskies who speak in tongues. And the fact that Rife was digging up this old city, Eridu. Yeah. And the radio astronomy thing. Lagos had a lot of stuff he was worried about. So he began to approach people. He approached us. Where'd they go? Hero says. Everyone's already looking for the float, as though they all noticed at once that it was missing. Finally they see it, a quarter mile behind them, dead in the water. The bigwigs and the bodyguards are standing up now, all looking in the same direction. The speedboat is circling around to retrieve it. They must have figured out a way to detach the tow cable, Hero says.
Not likely, the man with the glass eye says. It was attached to the bottom, under the water. And it's a steel cable, so there's no way they could cut it.
Hero sees another small craft bobbing on the water, about halfway between the Russians and the speedboat that was towing them. It's not obvious because it's tiny, close to the water, done up in dull natural colors. It's a one-man kayak, carrying a long-haired man.
Shit, Livio says. Where the hell did he come from?
The kayaker looks behind himself for a few moments, reading the waves, then suddenly turns back around and begins to paddle hard, accelerating, glancing back every few strokes. A big wave is coming, and just as it swells up underneath the kayak, he's matching its speed. The kayak stays on top of the wave and shoots forward like a missile, riding the swell, suddenly going twice as fast as anything else on the water. Digging at the wave with one end of his paddle, the kayaker makes a few crude changes in his direction. Then he parks the paddle athwart the kayak, reaches down inside, and hauls out a small dark object, a tube about 4 feet long, which he hoists up to one shoulder. He and the speedboat shoot past each other going in opposite directions, separated by a gap of only about 20 feet. Then the speedboat blows up. The Kowloon has overshot the site of all this action by a few thousand yards. It's pulling around into as tight a turn as a vessel of the size, trying to throw a 180 so it can go back and deal with the Russians, and somewhat more problematically, with Raven. Raven is paddling back toward his buddies.
He's such an asshole, Livio says. What's he going to do? Tow them out to the raft behind his fucking kayak?
This gives me the creeps, the man with the glass eye says. Make sure we got some guys up there with stingers. They must have a chopper coming or something.
No other ships on the radar,
says one of the other soldiers, coming in from the bridge.
Just us and them, and no choppers either.
You know Raven carries a nuke, right? Hero says.
So I heard, but that kayak's not big enough. It's tiny. I can't believe you'd go out to sea in something like that.
A mountain is growing out of the sea. A bubble of black water that keeps rising. Well behind the bung raft, a black tower appeared, jutting vertically out of the water, a pair of wings sprouting from its top. The tower keeps getting taller, the wings getting higher out of the water, as before and aft, the mountain rises and shapes itself. Red stars and a few numbers. But no one has to read the numbers to know it's a submarine. A nuclear missile submarine. Then it stops. So close to the Russians on their little raft that Gurov and friends can practically jump onto it. Raven paddles toward them, cutting through the waves like a glass knife.
Fuck me,
the man with the glass eye says. He is utterly astounded.
Fuck me, fuck me, fuck me. Uncle Enzo's gonna be pissed. You couldn't have known, Livio says. Should we shoot at him?
Before the man with the glass eye can make a policy decision, the deck gun on the top of the nuke sub opens up. The first shell misses them by just a few yards.
Okay, we got a rapidly evolving situation. Hero, you come with me.
The crew of the Kowloon has already sized up the situation and placed their bets on the nuclear submarine. They are running up and down the rails, dropping large fiberglass capsules into the water. the capsules break open to reveal bright orange folds which blossom into life rafts. Once the deck gunners on the nuke sub figure out how to hit the Kowloon, the situation begins to evolve even more rapidly. The Kowloon can't decide whether to sink, burn, or simply disintegrate, so it does all three at once. By that time, most of the people who were on it have made their way onto a life raft. They all bob on the water, zip themselves into orange survival suits, and watch the nuke sub. Raven is the last person to go below decks in the submarine. He spends a minute or two removing some gear from his kayak, a few items in bags, and one 8-foot spear with a translucent, leaf-shaped head. Before he disappears into the hatch, he turns toward the wreckage of the Kowloon and holds the harpoon up over his head, a gesture of triumph and a promise all at once. Then he's gone. A couple of minutes later, the submarine is gone too.
"That guy gives me the creeps," the man with the glass eye says.
Once it starts coming clear to her again that these people are all twisted freaks, she starts to notice other things about them. For example, the whole time, no one ever looks her in the eye, especially the men. No sex at all in these guys. They've got it pushed so far down inside of them. She can understand why they don't look at the fat babushkas, but she's a 15-year-old American chick, and she is used to getting the occasional look. Not here. Until she looks up from her big vat of fish one day and finds that she is looking into some guy's chest. And when she follows his chest upward to his neck, and his neck all the way up to his face, she sees dark eyes staring right back at her, right over the top of the counter. He's got something written on his forehead, "Poor Impulse Control," which is kind of scary. Sexy, too. It gives him a certain measure of romance that none of these other people have. She was expecting the raft to be dark and dangerous, and instead, it's just like working where her mother works. This guy is the first person she's seen around this place who really looks like he belongs on the raft. And he's got the look down, too. Incredibly rank style. Although he has a long, wispy mustache that doesn't do much for his face. Doesn't bring out his features well at all. "Do you take the nasty stuff?" "One fishheader, too," she says, dangling the ladle picturesquely. She always talks trash to people because none of them can understand what she's saying.
"I'll take whatever you're offering," the guy says, in English, sort of a crisp accent.
"I'm not offering anything," she says. "But if you want to stand there and browse, that's cool."
He stands there and browses for a while, long enough that people farther back in line stand up on tiptoe to see what the problem is. But when they see that the problem is this particular individual, they get down off their toes real fast, hunch down, sort of blend into the mass of fishy-smelling wool.
"What's for dessert today?" the guy asks. "Got anything sweet for me?"
"We don't believe in dessert," YT says. "It's a fucking sin, remember?"
"Depends on your cultural orientation."
"Oh yeah? What culture are you oriented to?"
"I am an Aleut."
"Oh, I've never heard of that."
"That's because we've been fucked over," the big scary Aleut says. "Worse than any other people in history."
"Sorry to hear that," YT says. "So, do you want me to serve up some fish, or are you going to stay hungry?"
The big Aleut stares at her for a while. Then he jerks his head sideways and says,
"Come on, let's get the fuck out of here."
"What, and skip out on this cool job?"
He grins ridiculously.
"I can find you a better job."
"In this job, do I get to leave my clothes on?"
"Come on, we're going now,"
he says, those eyes burning into her. She tries to ignore a sudden, warm, tense feeling down between her legs. She starts following him down the cafeteria line, heading for a gap where she can exit into the dining area. The head babushka bitch comes stomping out from in back, hollers at her in some incomprehensible language. YT turns to look back.
she feels a pair of big hands sliding up her sides, coming up into her armpits, and she pulls her arms to her sides, trying to stop it. But it's no good. The hands come all the way up and keep lifting, keep rising into the air, bringing her with them. The big guy hoists her right up over the counter like she's a 3-year-old and sets her down next to him. YT turns back around to see the head babushka bitch, but she is frozen in a mixture of surprise, fear, and sexual outrage. But in the end, fear wins out. She averts her eyes, turns away, and goes to replace YT at VAT position number 9.
"Thanks for the lift," YT says,
her voice wowing and fluttering ridiculously.
Didn't you want to eat something?"
"I was thinking of going out anyway," he says.
"Going out? Where do you go out on the raft?"
"Come on. I'll show you."
He leads her down passageways and up steep steel stairways and out onto the deck. It's getting close to twilight. The control tower of the Enterprise looms hard and black against a deep gray sky that's getting dark and gloomy so fast that it seems darker now than it will at midnight. But for now, none of the lights are on, and that's all there is, black steel and slate sky. She follows him down the deck of the ship to the stern. From here, it's a 30-foot drop to the water. They are looking out across the prosperous, clean, white neighborhood of the Russian people, separated from the squalid, dark tangle of the raft, per se, by a wide canal patrolled by gun-toting black robes. There's no stairway or rope ladder here, but there is a thick rope hanging from the railing. The big Aleut guy hauls up a chunk of rope and drapes it under one arm and over one leg in a quick motion. Then he throws one arm around YT's waist, gathering her in the crook of his arm, leans back, and falls off the ship. She absolutely refuses to scream. She feels the rope stop his body, feels his arm squeeze her so tight she chokes for a moment, and then she's hanging there, hanging in the crook of his arm. She's got her arms down to her side, defiant. But just for the hell of it, she leans into him, wraps her arms around his neck, puts her head on his shoulder, and hangs on tight. He rappels them down the rope, and soon they are standing on the sanitized, prosperous Russian version of the raft. "What's your name, anyway?" she says.
"Dmitry Ravanov," he says, "better known as Raven."
"Oh! Shit."
The connections between boats are tangled and unpredictable. To get from point A to point B, you have to wander all over the place. But Raven knows where he's going. Occasionally, he reaches out, grabs her hand, but he doesn't yank her around even though she's going a lot slower than he is. Every so often, he looks back at her with a grin like, "I could hurt you, but I won't." They come to a place where the Russian neighborhood is joined to the rest of the raft by a wide plank bridge guarded by Uzi dudes. Raven ignores them, takes YT's hand again, and walks right across the bridge with her. YT hardly has time to think through the implications of this before it hits her. She looks around, sees all these gaunt Asians staring back at her like she's a 5-course meal, and realizes, "I'm on the raft. Actually on the raft."
"These are Hong Kong Vietnamese," Raven says. "Started out in Vietnam. Came to Hong Kong as boat people after the war there. So they've been living on sampans for a couple of generations now. Don't be scared. This isn't dangerous for you."
"I don't think I can find my way back here," YT says.
"Relax," he says. "I've never lost a girlfriend."
"Have you ever had a girlfriend?"
Raven throws back his head and laughs.
"A lot. In the old days. Not as many in the past few years."
"Oh yeah? The old days. Is that when you got your tattoo?"
"Yeah. I'm an alcoholic. Used to get in a lot of trouble.
been sober for 8 years.
Then how come everyone's scared of you?
Raven turns to her, smiles broadly, shrugs.
Oh, because I'm an incredibly ruthless, efficient, cold-blooded killer. You know.
YT laughs. So does Raven.
What's your job? YT asks.
I'm a harpooner, he says.
Like in Moby Dick?
YT likes this idea. She read that book in school. Most of the people in her class, even the power tools, thought that the book was totally entrenched. But she liked all the stuff about harpooning.
Nah. Compared to me, those Moby Dicksters were faggots.
What kind of stuff do you harpoon?
You name it.
From there on out, she just looks at him, or at inanimate objects. Because otherwise, she wouldn't see anything except thousands of dark eyes staring back at her. In that way, it's a big change from being a slop-slinger for the repressed.
Part of it is just because she's so different. But part of it is that there's no privacy on the raft. You make your way around by hopping from one boat to the next. But each boat is home to about 3 dozen people, so it's like you are constantly walking through people's living rooms and bathrooms and bedrooms. Naturally, they look. They trot across a makeshift platform built on oil drums. A couple of Vietnamese dudes are there arguing or haggling over something. Looks like a slab of fish. The one who's turned toward them sees them coming. His eyes flicker across YT without pausing, fix on Raven, and go wide. He steps back. The guy he's talking to, who has his back to them, turns around and literally jumps into the air, letting out a suppressed grunt. Both of them back well out of Raven's path. And then she figures out something important. These people aren't looking at her. They're not even giving her a second glance. They're all looking at Raven. And it's not just a case of celebrity watching or something like that. All of these raft dudes, these tough, scary homeboys of the sea, are scared shitless of this guy. And she's on a date with him. And it's just started. Suddenly, walking through another Vietnamese living room, YT has a flashback to the most excruciating conversation she ever had, which was a year ago when her mother tried to give her advice on what to do if a boy got fresh with her. Yeah, Mom, right. I'll keep that in mind. Yeah, I'll be sure to remember that. YT knew that advice was worthless, and this goes to show she was right. Ambangala manura lariya. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, you the sheesh. There are 4 men in the life raft. Hero protagonist, self-employed stringer for the Central Intelligence Corporation, whose practice used to be limited to so-called dry operations, meaning that he sat around and soaked up information and then later spat it back into the library, the CIC database, without ever actually doing anything. Now his practice has become formidably wet. Hero is armed with 2 swords and a 9mm semi-automatic pistol, known colloquially as a 9, with 2 ammunition clips, each carrying 11 rounds. Vic, unspecified last name. If there was still such a thing as income tax, then every year when Vic filled out his 1040 form, he would put down as his occupation, sniper. In classic sniper style, Vic is reticent, unobtrusive. He is armed with a long, large caliber rifle with a bulky mechanism mounted on its top, where a telescopic sight might be found if Vic were not at the leading edge of his profession. The exact nature of this device is not obvious, but Hero presumes that it is an exquisitely precise sensor package, with fine crosshairs superimposed on the middle. Vic may safely be presumed to be carrying additional small concealed weapons. Elliot Chung. Elliot used to be the skipper of a boat called the Kowloon. At the moment, he is between jobs. Elliot grew up in Watts, and when he speaks English, he sounds like a black guy. Genetically speaking, he is entirely Chinese.
He is fluent in both black and white English, as well as Cantonese, taxi lingua, and some Vietnamese, Spanish, and Mandarin. Elliot is armed with a .44 Magnum revolver, which he carried on board the Kowloon just for the halibut, i.e., he used it to execute halibut before passengers hauled them on board. Halibut grow very large and can thrash so violently that they can easily kill the people who hook them. Hence, it is prudent to fire a number of shells through their heads before taking them on board. This is the only reason Elliot carries a weapon. The other defensive needs of the Kowloon were seen to by crew members who were specialists in that kind of thing. Fisheye. This is the man with the glass eye. He will only identify himself by his nickname. He is armed with a large, fat, black suitcase. The suitcase is massively constructed, with built-in wheels, and weighs somewhere between 300 pounds and a metric ton, as Hero discovers when he tries to move it. Its weight turns the normally flat bottom of the life raft into a puckered cone. The suitcase has a noteworthy attachment. A flexible 3-inch thick cable or hose or something, a couple of meters long, that emerges from one corner, runs up the sloping floor of the life raft, over the edge, and trails in the water. At the end of this mysterious tentacle is a hunk of metal about the size of a wastebasket, but so finely sculpted into so many narrow fins and veins that it appears to have a surface area the size of Delaware. Hero only saw this thing out of the water for a few chaotic moments when it was being transferred into the life raft. At that time, it was glowing red hot. Since then, it has lurked below the surface, light gray, impossible to see clearly because the water around it is forever churning in a full rolling boil. Fist-sized bubbles of steam coalesce amid its fractal tracery of hot veins and pummel the surface of the ocean ceaselessly, all day and all night. The powerless life raft, sloshing around the North Pacific, emits a vast, spreading plume of steam, like that of an iron horse chugging full blast over the continental divide. Neither Hero nor Elliot ever mentions or even notices the by now obvious fact that Fisheye is traveling with a small, self-contained nuclear power source, almost certainly radiothermal isotopes, like the ones that power the rat thing. As long as Fisheye refuses to notice this fact, it would be rude for them to bring it up. All of the participants are clad in bright orange padded suits that cover their entire bodies. They are the North Pacific version of life vests. They are bulky and awkward, but Elliot Chung likes to say that in northern waters, the only thing a life vest does is make your corpse float. The lifeboat is an inflatable raft about 10 feet long that does not come equipped with a motor. It has a tent-like, waterproof canopy that they can zip up all the way around, turning it into a sealed capsule so that the water stays out even in the most violent weather. For a couple of days, a powerful chill wind coming down out off the mountains drives them out of Oregon, out toward the open water. Elliot explains, cheerfully, that this lifeboat was invented back in the old days, when they had navies and coast guards that would come and rescue stranded travelers. All you had to do was float and be orange. Fisheye has a walkie-talkie, but it is a short-range device. And Hero's computer is capable of jacking into the net, but in this regard, it functions much like a cellular telephone. It doesn't work out in the middle of nowhere. When the weather is extremely rainy, they sit under the canopy. When it's less rainy, they sit above it. They all have ways of passing the time. Hero dicks around with his computer, naturally. Being stranded on a life raft in the Pacific is a perfect venue for a hacker. Vic reads and rereads a soaked paperback novel that he had in the pocket of his windbreaker when the Kowloon got blown out from under them. These days of waiting are much easier for him. As a professional sniper, he knows how to kill time. Elliot looks at things with his binoculars, even though there is very little to look at. He spends a lot of time messing around with the raft, fretting about it in the way that boat captains do. And he does a lot of fishing. They have plenty of stored food on the raft, but the occasional fresh halibut and salmon are nice to eat. Fisheye has taken what appears to be an instruction manual from the heavy black suitcase. It is a miniature three-ring binder with pages of laser-printed text. The binder is just a cheap, unmarked one bought from a stationery store. In these respects, it is perfectly familiar to Hero. It bears the earmarks of a high-tech product that is still under development. All technical devices require documentation of a sort, but this stuff can only be written by the techies who are doing the actual product development, and they absolutely hate it, always put the docs question off to the very last minute. Then they type up some material on a word processor, run it off on the laser printer, send the departmental secretary out for a cheap binder, and that's that. But this only occupies Fisheye for a little while. He spends the rest of the time just staring off at the horizon, as though he's expecting Sicily to heave into view. It doesn't. He is despondent over the failure of his mission, and spends a lot of time mumbling under his breath, trying to find a way to salvage it.
"If you don't mind my asking," Hero says, "what was your mission anyway?"
Fisheye thinks this one over for a while.
"Well, it depends on how you look at it. Nominally, my objective is to get a 15-year-old girl back from these assholes. So my tactic was to take a bunch of their bigwigs hostage, then arrange a trade. Who's this 15-year-old girl?"
Fisheye shrugs.
"You know her. It's YT. Is that really your whole objective? The important thing is, Hero, that you have to understand the Mafia way. And the Mafia way is that we pursue larger goals under the guise of personal relationships. So, for example, when you were a pizza guy, you didn't deliver pizzas fast because you made more money that way or because it was some kind of a fucking policy. You did it because you were carrying out a personal covenant between Uncle Enzo and every customer. This is how we avoid the trap of self-perpetuating ideology. Ideology is a virus. So getting this chick back is more than just getting a chick back. It's the concrete manifestation of an abstract policy goal. And we like concrete. Right, Vic?"
Vic allows himself a judicious sneer and a deep grinding laugh.
"What's the abstract policy goal in this case?" Hero says. "Not my department," Fisheye says. "But I think Uncle Enzo is real pissed at L. Bob Reif."
Hero is messing around in Flatland. He is doing this partly to conserve the computer's batteries. Rendering a three-dimensional office takes a lot of processors working full-time, while a simple two-dimensional desktop display requires minimal power. But his real reason for being in Flatland is that Hero Protagonist, last of the freelance hackers, is hacking. And when hackers are hacking, they don't mess around with the superficial world of metaverses and avatars. They descend below this surface layer and into the netherworld of code and tangled namshubs that supports it, where everything that you see in the metaverse, no matter how lifelike and beautiful and three-dimensional, reduces to a simple text file, a series of letters on an electronic page. It is a throwback to the days when people programmed computers through primitive teletypes and IBM punch cards. Since then, pretty and user-friendly programming tools have been developed. It's possible to program a computer now by sitting at your desk in the metaverse and manually connecting little pre-programmed units like Tinker Toys. But a real hacker would never use such techniques, any more than a master auto mechanic would try to fix a car by sliding in behind the steering wheel and watching the idiot lights on the dashboard. Hero does not know what he is doing, what he is preparing for. That's okay, though. Most of programming is a matter of laying groundwork, building structures of words that seem to have no particular connection to the task at hand. He knows one thing. The metaverse has now become a place where you can get killed. Or at least, have your brain reamed out to the point where you might as well be dead. This is a radical change in the nature of the place. Guns have come to paradise. It serves them right, he realizes now. They made the place too vulnerable. They figured that the worst thing that could happen was that a virus might get transferred into your computer and force you to ungoggle and reboot your system,
maybe destroy a little data if you were stupid enough not to install any medicine. Therefore, the metaverse is wide open and undefended, like airports in the days before bombs and metal detectors, like elementary schools in the days before maniacs with assault rifles. Anyone can go in and do anything they want to. There are no cops. You can't defend yourself. You can't chase the bad people. It's going to take a lot of work to change